you want to get an edge over Vegas, download BetQL, the app you need to get an advantage this season. Discover value bets, line movement, and find out what bets the public backs with BetQL. The best part, BetQL is free to download from your mobile device. Head to betql.co and use promo code CAPSPACE to get a 3-day trial. Give yourself an advantage over Vegas and download BetQL. That's betql.co and promo code CAPSPACE. Big show today. Going to bring in Derek Bodner after this to talk Sixers. Markelle Fultz, we pre-recorded that, actually got a lot of really interesting talk about Fultz, Embiid, Steph, Simmons, the long-term outlook for the franchise. Really always enjoy having Derek on. He's the best when it comes to the Sixers. But first, we got some news that is piled up, starting, Danny, with an odd firing out of Phoenix and what has become an October tradition for the Phoenix Suns.
October surprises. I guess they're really common in Phoenix and Arizona. And this is another head scratcher for a variety of reasons. And actually, there are parallels with the Earl Watson firing last year, which is, so Robert Sarver, their owner, fired Ryan McDonough, their general manager, about 15 months after giving him an extension. And after he basically put together this year's team, there are still some potential moves that could be made. I mean, we've been seeing murmurs that they've been going after point guards forever, but it goes along with this story. I mean, this has been something I've said numerous times on Dunked On. If you don't want somebody to run your team, once you've made that decision, don't have them run your team anymore. Like, I don't understand what changed between now and whatever other point there was where it's happened. I mean, very little has happened with the Suns other than the Knight Chris trade in the last few months, and then after their flurry of activity in July. So what are they really doing here? They're also doing a disservice. I mean, think about the old adage of hire your GM and give your GM the authority to hire a coach. Well, it seemed like they did that because they gave their GM an extension a year before they hired their coach. But now Kokoschkov is going to coach his first NBA regular season game without a general manager.
Yeah, and it has been reported by Woj that James Jones seems like the likely replacement. A number of McDonough loyalists were fired as well. Courtney Whitty, who came over from the Clippers in a personnel capacity, Pat Connolly as well, and I think a couple others whose names escape me at the moment. But so they're very thin right now. I mean, not a time where you need a ton of scouting staff. I mean, you might be looking to claim guys off of waivers for a two-way or whatever, but they've got a pretty full roster in Phoenix right now. So that's not the end of the world, but right. I mean, it really does make no sense to do it right now. I mean, what was the tipping point? I mean, some have speculated that it was the inability to acquire a starting point guard for this season. You know, there's talk they might be going after Terry Rozier or you know, some other logical trade candidates, but you know, Boston, I think, wants a lot for Rozier. Maybe justifiably so. Maybe he's a little bit overrated in terms of an asset these days. But so he couldn't do that. And then just that, you know, in preseason, the team didn't look too good. They clearly made these win now moves. It also seems very clear that Sarver and Woj really unloaded on him in this piece. You know, McDonough is Woj's guy. And now we're seeing this now that McDonough is out. You know, I think a lot of these details that Woj was kind of sitting on come out now after his guy gets fired. But Sarver, you know, is kind of retired from his other businesses the last couple of years, and certainly he's been very involved, according to Woj, in basketball decision making. And that's not to imply that Woj is, like, you know, making stuff up. Like, Woj's stuff is always good stuff. It's just, you know, kind of when does it end up getting released? It can be an interesting question with him. So it seems clear that all this yo-yoing back and forth, not picking a direction, some of the head-scratching moves, signing Ariza, trying to win now, trading away that 2021 Miami pick and number 16 to move up to number 10 after he'd already been selected, Bridges. I mean, that there's just a lot of these moves, which, you know, you don't know for sure that was Sarver, but also really because they're so weird, you think they probably are.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly an argument that can be made. I mean, the idea of, you know, not really following a draft pick board, that seems like something maybe more that an owner would do. And yeah, there were anecdotes in Woj's piece talking about Sarver having conversations with agents outside of the front office, kind of not the same thing as what's happening with Glenn Taylor, but kind of a similar flavor of bad ownership there. Just, you know, not letting your personnel people do personnel things. And that makes it very hard. And it also, like, I mean, there are a bunch of different angles of this, but one of them is it also makes it hard to get good people to work in your organization. And so, I mean, one of the most prominent general managing prospects out there is David Griffin, who did a really nice job in Cleveland overall. Well, David Griffin has plenty of experience with Robert Sarver, and I cannot speak to it. I have not talked to David Griffin about this, but I'm guessing he wouldn't be super interested in that position, as desirable as GM jobs are, just because there are so many things that come with it that are unnecessary headaches and make it harder to do your job well.
Yeah. Now, certainly McDonough had his own problems. There's a rash of anti-McDonough sentiment and told you so's from various players when he was fired. Some of those players, in fact, who McDonough had paid, or at least Sarver had. Not to say that McDonough was perfect here, and we've talked about too, part of your job as a GM is being able to manage the owner and being able to curb their worst impulses. And now maybe Sarver wanted someone who wasn't going to do that, and McDonough did last 5 years there, perhaps because he was not quote unquote standing up to Sarver. Maybe he would have just never had his contract renewed. That would be getting to a second contract with Sarver is actually impressive, and actually getting an extension before your contract is up is really impressive with Sarver.
Still has two more years on his contract, so I mean the fact that Sarver is willing to pay him not to be there anymore is surprising.
Yeah, no, I mean, because you'll remember back in the Steve Kerr era, they didn't want to give anybody extensions at the end of that great 2010 season, and Kerr ended up leaving because he and his staff weren't taken care of at that point. And Sarver is just like, well, why would I ever give someone an extension? Which, I do think the, oh my God, no coach or GM can ever be a free agent thing is a little overblown. GM is probably more accurate of a criticism, a better axiom that you shouldn't have a lame duck GM, because you run into that issue of just making short-term moves to save your job. Sarver went probably too far in the extreme to the opposite there. And this is why we ranked Robert Sarver among the worst owners in the league. I mean, even going back to the time with the Suns, with luxury tax avoidance, trading away Luol Deng and Rajon Rondo and dumping Kurt Thomas with two first-round picks, one of which became Serge Ibaka. I mean, he definitely made that window of Phoenix contention end sooner than it should have, and they obviously have never even gotten close to back to that afterwards. You had him as your bottom owner, didn't you?
I believe that I did, and I stand by it.
I think mine was MJ.
That sounds right. That podcast is available for those who want to listen to it.
On Stitcher Premium.
Yes.
Let's do a couple quick hitters here. In New York, Courtney Lee, with a sore neck, is slated now to miss the entire preseason, and that's never a great indication that they're going to start the season on time. I mean, Lee is really the only thing remotely approximating a two-way guy on the wing. Looks like Lance Thomas is going to start at the four right now. He's had a couple of injury-plagued years, but if he's healthy, I think he can contribute a little bit, but certainly isn't going to help New York's scoring problems there. And then Mitchell Robinson did have an ankle sprain, but it looks like kind of more of a week or two type of thing, not as serious as it looked. And then in OKC, they have had all kinds of problems.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. The news that Andre Robertson, he had a setback coming back from his knee surgery on his left patella. And the current phraseology here
is two knee surgeries,
that's right.
On his left patella,
Is that he will be reevaluated. And reevaluated is always a very important term here. That is, does not mean return. That just means that's the next time they're going to look at it in two months. And Royce Young adding a little bit of color that Robertson was on track to be back sometime in November. And so... And he mentioned that his return to play would be longer than that 2 month, which is exactly what we said in terms of being reevaluated then. And we still really haven't heard much about Russell Westbrook's return to the floor either.
Yeah, we haven't. Just to finish up on Robertson, I mean, the timeline, torn patellar tendon, then I think it was late June, early July, I want to say it was June, was suffering some swelling, had to have a second procedure. He will now have a third procedure, this one to address potentially a loose stitch, which you remember that term from Russell Westbrook's return from meniscus surgery back in 2013-14, where he ended up having three surgeries as well. And so, yeah, reevaluate in 2 months. I mean, you have to imagine it's three before he's playing again. And the Thunder are extremely, extremely thin on the wing. You know, they've been starting. Terrence Ferguson actually has a concussion right now, but they're starting him. You know, TLC is in that mix. Hamidou Diallo played like 25 minutes the other night.
I mean, Abrinas is a possibility. I mean, and all of these guys are imperfect. And one of the options once Westbrook returns would be Dennis Schroeder, but Schroeder hasn't occupied that role, and neither Westbrook nor Schroeder has spent meaningful time guarding two guards. So that puts a lot.
Well, that's not true, actually. Schroeder guarded Bradley Beal a lot in the playoffs and actually did okay.
Yeah, that's true. I guess he did have that moment.
He can like chase guys around if he's like, all right, I got to lock in on this guy. It's when he has to like actually be, you know, a closeout guy. It doesn't look too good, but you know, maybe he can be better. But yeah, you started talking about Westbrook. So what's the latest with him?
Well, so he still hasn't returned to practice. And I mean, we're recording this almost exactly a week before the start of the regular season. So when somebody hasn't returned to practice, you kind of assume that it might linger on a little bit longer, which is another real challenge for them because then they have to replace another guy in the rotation. But one thing I want to go back to with Robertson just briefly, and this ties in with Westbrook.
We can't stop talking about Andre Robertson.
No, is that because he's out for much longer, you get all these cascading effects of not only do you have to find a starter, but somebody's going to have to fill in with the backup role, but it compromises a lot of what made Oklahoma City's defense so good. And I mean, now Paul George is just going to have a lot more on his plate defensively. We'll see if that affects him offensively or if they just sacrifice a little bit on that end. They have the personnel to handle it, but they don't have really any perfect solutions. And so another reason that I was uncomfortable with the Schroeder thing, and maybe I'm wrong, maybe Schroeder fits in that role perfectly, and Sam Presti knows a lot more than I do on this specific point, but throwing as many resources as they have into those kind of positions and then taking more flyers on the wing has consequences. And so now they're going to have to see how it works. You never know, like it could have been somebody in a different position that got hurt, but they're going to have to scramble here. And that doesn't, I'm not saying like they're going to miss the playoffs or anything like that, but it does get a lot harder.
Yeah, and with Westbrook, I mean, he took some light contact, I think, today, but he hasn't been cleared for full contact. And that, you know, full contact, that's usually, all right, we're going to play one-on-one, two-on-two for a while. And then, you know, I mean, it's really hard to imagine that he'll be ready within the next 2 weeks on the timeline that we've seen so far. So you have to imagine, certainly opening night against the Warriors, it'll kill him to miss that. But, you know, that's not the game they want him coming back for either. So that game will lose a little bit of its luster, especially with it being in Golden State. And then you just have to wonder about the Thunder. They have not been very effective with Westbrook off the floor, although they do at least have Felton as a backup point guard option beyond Schroeder, who's had some moments in the preseason. Let's go now to the Jimmy Butler situation. Butler, we are now 3 weeks into that, reiterating on Monday per John Krasinski and Shams Charania that he wants out of Minnesota. But there was also a report that he doesn't plan to miss regular season games per Woj, which, you know, I guess forfeit the game checks. Now, there's still always things he could do. He can get a nagging injury. He can, you know, just play like crap and not try. You know, I mean, there's a lot of things here. You know, Thibodeau still thinks he can bring him back. Tibbs, you know, is, hey, we're paying you, do your job. You know, he doesn't, not exactly focused on the interpersonal dynamics of things, it would seem. But then it was odd, the amount of leaks that we've had about these deals with the Heat that have not ultimately, of course, gone through as of yet.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting into there was a part of the Krasinski-Shromny piece that came out on Tuesday that got into what I think has to be the biggest challenge of this whole circumstance if you are opposing GM, which is, who are you talking to and what kind of leverage exists here? Because generally speaking, I mean, you would say for a player who, especially one who is on an expiring contract, that value drops every day because that's one fewer day that he can be on his new team. I mean, you see that all over the place, you know, guys at the deadline are usually acquired for less than guys at, you know, before the season and so on and so forth. But it seems like what Minnesota, what say Thibodeau Layden, what they're feeling like is that, well, the offers are so bad now, they can't get worse. And they might be right. It's entirely possible that they are. But the idea that teams are going to like fall over themselves to give Minnesota more leverage here when they're getting a smaller amount of Jimmy Butler is challenging. It's kind of one of those circumstances where to me, it's this idea that it's that the coach is feeding the GM, like, well, if the offers aren't good, we might as well keep him, and who knows, maybe he'll come. And so you get into that idea where you kind of stay in something for too long because there are ways that it benefits Thibodeau personally.
Yeah. Now, that could all just be posturing too. You know, I mean, it could be, oh, hey, we'll really keep him if these offers don't get better. But some of the permutations that were out there for Miami, I think, were interesting. You know, the criticism, of course, has been the quote out of Miami in a Barry Jackson piece was a Heat official saying they're asking for each of our firstborn children, I guess it would be. And there is a discussion that the Heat relented. They were including Josh Richardson in some talks. Now, maybe they're willing to include Richardson if the Wolves also took on a bad contract. So you don't know that, like, okay, they included Richardson, so that makes it fair. But we talked about this before. I think that, like, Richardson for Butler straight up is pretty fair. You know, I think if the Wolves are asking for that, for more than that, which it seems like they probably are, whether it's salary relief with Gorgui Dieng, whether it's another young player like Bam Adebayo, I don't think that it's really fair to do that, frankly. I think that, and so if they're still like, okay, we want a young player and a rotation player and a pick, he's not worth that much, and you are being unrealistic if that is in fact the asking price, but we don't know that, of course, for sure.
Clearly, apropos of nothing, Bam Adebayo has not been playing during the preseason. It looks like he has an issue with his right shoulder, and Richardson, I believe, has been playing. Is that correct? He wasn't at the beginning, but I think he came back. Maybe I'm wrong on that.
I think he's back now. With James Johnson not playing at all either, they're coming back from that hernia surgery, which is a long time to be out with a hernia surgery. I think he had that back in May. So you worried a little bit that there might be a complication there. And then Adebayo as well, for his part, is actually back now. He's playing through the shoulder injury. He played in their most recent preseason game on Monday. Played 24 minutes. So I there was some concern that he hadn't really been practicing, but now that apparently is alleviated.
Yeah, that was a bad fall. I was watching Derek it live. Jones, that was, yeah. It was very concerning. And Richardson,
you're talking about the Derek Jones fall.
Yeah, I was watching that live. And Richardson played 26 minutes in the aforementioned game on Monday. So he is back in full force, or at least in that version of full force. We might as well go to the really disheartening news out of San Antonio that DeJounte Murray is out for this entire season with a torn ACL. He was the centerpiece, really, for what interested me about San Antonio this year, the true transition piece as they kind of moved out of that era. I mean, with Kawhi and Manu leaving, but of course they still have LaMarcus and DeMar DeRozan. And so now a lot of playmaking on the shoulders of those two guys, presumably Patty Mills will get some. And then also the cascading problem I talk about a lot, where when you have to move a guy from the second unit to the starting lineup, then you have to find a replacement for him in the second unit. And so it sounds like that might be Derek White, but San Antonio, you know, Spurs magic is going to have to go a lot further now than it was going to a week ago.
Yeah, Murray, everyone had been raving about the way his jump shot looked early in camp, the work he'd done over the summer with Chip Engelin. We never really got to see whether that was true, but certainly had it been, you know, that would have been a big improvement for him. And obviously he was already really a shark defensively. And so this is going to be a big opportunity for Derek White, who did almost nothing last year, but had a nice summer league. He is 24 already, a late bloomer. Someone that I know Mike Schmitz is like, White isn't really quite your every down pick and roll player, but he doesn't need to be if they got DeRozan on the roster as well. And he's kind of a jack of all trades, master of none type offensively, but that player can be valuable. You know, that's what he's supposed to be. And we haven't seen him be effective there at the NBA level yet. And, you know, Mills will play a lot more now. I do think they'll be better offensively with Mills out there than with Murray, just because they desperately need someone spacing the floor. And so if in fact Mills starts, which he may not, they still seem to really like bringing him off the bench. But if Mills starts, I do actually think they'll be better offensively, but obviously worse on defense, where Murray had shown so much promise. And then a player who might have been able to take advantage of the absence of Murray, he's now looking at potentially much of a lost year. 6 to 8 week prognostication for Lonnie Walker after another meniscus surgery. He had one in the same knee prior to his season at Miami, and you'll recall there were some rumors that he fell in the draft because of that knee issue, and now to have had surgery again, I think it was another acute injury that he suffered in practice. But you know, this probably puts him Christmas, New Year's before he's coming back. And with Greg Popovich not particularly fond of rookies, with Walker also a guy who only played 1 year in college, very young. You didn't necessarily expect him to make a huge impact this year anyway, but it seems like there's almost no chance of that now unless they're just totally out of it by the end of the year.
It could make it easier to have the Spurs give him some time in Austin and just really focus on development. Hey, we need to get you right. We need to teach you the methodology and all that. And I am excited to see what this development team does with a player who's physically talented and young. That's what's going on with DeJounte Murray as well. And the early signs have been strong there, but we will have to see it. Dwight Howard also is dealing with what was originally believed to be a back injury, but reporting on Tuesday is indicating I hadn't heard this word ever in my life. I'm going to say piriformis.
Oh, well, when your wife is a yoga teacher, you have heard that
okay.
word before.
Did I?
Piriformis, which Shams helpfully notes is a muscle in the buttocks. But I already knew that because my wife is a yoga teacher. All that stuff is connected. The glutes, the lower back, where Howard, of course, had surgery. And really, you know, a lot of Howard's fortunes, I think, has been an underrated factor in his performance the last few years, has been health. You know, I think he has days where he looks real spry and he can explode with his knee issues, his back issues, feeling okay. He was supposed to have a pain-killing injection as well. But, you know, certainly if he's not practicing right now, again, a week before the regular season starts, you wonder whether it's going to be a jeopardy. And so I guess Jan Mahimi is going to start. Jason Smith time. I mean, they do not have a lot behind him at center. And then Markieff Morris suffering from an abdominal injury. We don't know the severity of it yet, but worth recalling that he had hernia surgery around this time last year. And, you know, that's not a great sign as well. If he is again suffering from some of those issues.
We can move on to a little bit more positive news from Indiana. Thaddeus Young has been out. We've been concerned about his absence because of Indiana's issues at the four, but he returned to practice, could play in the last preseason game, so hopes are that he'll be ready to start the regular season.
Someone who, you know, everyone's been downplaying the injury is Draymond Green. Sore knee, he's really missed, I think, over a week of practice now. He went through shoot around on Monday, did not play though. The hope was he could return on Wednesday against the Lakers. Looks like he's not going to play in that game either in Las Vegas, although Steve Kerr quipped that he would be making the trip with the team since it was Las Vegas. But this is just the kind of nagging injury he played through a lot last year. Green is not known necessarily as a workout warrior in terms of taking care of his body. He's getting into his late 20s. This is, you know, we'll see. I mean, he's, you know, talking about trying to be defensive player of the year again this year. This could be nothing, but it's just not a great sign. These kind of nagging things, the short power forward, how long is he going to last? I mean, that's one of the major questions, obviously, with, you know, Klay Thompson and KD staying after this year are the first two, but how well Green ages is another question for this team. And, you know, with last year's regular season, you know, it doesn't look like necessarily he's going to be able to give that crazy effort that he gave, you know, in the 3 years before last year over the course of the entire regular season is another data point against
it. Could also have big financial implications for Green. I've written about this extensively at The Athletic for those who are interested, but Green is currently not eligible for a designated veteran extension, and he could become eligible either by winning Defensive Player of the Year, something he has talked about, or by being an All-NBA selection this year. And because of the current extension system, it is possible that he is not willing to accept something at the, you know, what are the quote-unquote normal extension rules. And so even though the Warriors...
Yeah, 3 years, $72 million is the most he could get, but that would have to be before the regular season if you were going to do that, and he's obviously not going to. But, you know, I think it'd be very interesting to see, does he get more than $72 million guaranteed on his next contract if he waits all the way until free agency? If I were him, I would actually think very seriously about taking that, but, you know, seeing all these other guys get paid, it's got to be difficult to just do that sort of risk mitigation. But let's see where he's at in a couple years.
And it's possible that the extension negotiations next summer, because Green will not be a free agent until 2020, will take a different tenor, and that maybe they can come to some sort of agreement at that point, and by then they'll have clarity.
They could offer him another year,
and they could offer, and they'll have more clarity on what's happening with Klay and KD, and so how much money they have. That next season, 19-20 will be the Warriors' first season under the repeater tax, so they'll have a more clear idea of what their financial present and future is at that juncture. But it is still important to keep in the background. I mean, the Warriors are the title favorites this year, so whatever changes it. And let's jump to another title contender this year, an interesting interesting piece of news from the Boston Celtics. Kyrie Irving went to a kind of a tip-off event, a season ticket holder type thing at the Garden, and told them that he's, quote, planning on re-signing here, meaning Boston, next year. And I always want to preface these. It's kind of like what a college football player says when they're thinking about their draft stock at the before their bowl game, and they can, you know, they can say whatever they want. They're not held to it. But
I don't remember anyone ever being this vehement.
And that's
about
what I wanted to say, is that he didn't have to do this at all. He could have said nothing. He could, even if he was asked a directed question. I mean, we're seeing this all over the league right now because there's so many guys that are going to be free agents this upcoming summer. He didn't have to say anything. He chose to. I think this is a very, very positive sign for the Celtics that he will come back. Now, would I feel so confident in that that I would like trade Terry Rozier? No, because you don't know if Kyrie's going to stay healthy. Don't know, you know, don't know anything until the contract is signed. Rozier will be a restricted free agent, but Danian should be feeling better about his position there, and meaningfully so, than he was, unless these overtures had already been made privately. But even then, making it privately versus making it publicly.
Yeah, they had been actually per Shams, but yeah, you're obviously doubling down, and you know, Kyrie would have a lot of egg on his face if he leaves after saying this. But I do think it's almost more likely to me that, you know, something might happen with Kyrie and his recovery or his performance this year to where the Celtics wouldn't necessarily want to offer him just, you know, the whatever you want, 5-year, $190 million contract, which is the most they can give him. And that maybe that could throw a wrench into things if he just doesn't play as well. So, you know, he certainly has quite the injury history. And we'll see how he looks. He's looked a little slow to me early in camp, but you know, that's expected after missing as much time as he did. In Brooklyn, Alan Crabb looked to have severely sprained his ankle last night. X-rays were negative, but we don't know what the severity of that is quite yet. Rondae Hollis-Jefferson suffered a left adductor or groin strain in the offseason. He may not be ready for opening night. He's still a limited participant in practice. And then Shaz Napier suffered a hamstring injury early in camp. He's still not playing either. So again, you got to wonder if he's going to be ready for the start of the regular season, but they do have good point guard depth. And then the last thing to mention is a former guest on this podcast way back in the early days and famous NBA bettor Bob Vulgaris has been hired by the Dallas Mavericks to basically, it sounds from the title like he's going to be involved in their analytics. I know there are certainly some people who are seeing Bob's Twitter account who are looking forward to welcoming him to the reality of the NBA, but you know, Bob certainly probably more than anyone in the private sphere, to be sure, I would imagine, has put in more time on analytics and following the game. And so he, of course, is able to predict performance with his betting. And so, you know, predicting performance is a huge part of, obviously, evaluation and personnel moves in the NBA. So I'm very curious to see what happens with him. But, you know, certainly a guy with a great resume for Dallas to hire. And I'm guessing he probably didn't come cheap either.
I'm happy for Bob that he's going to get this opportunity with the team. Dallas is a fascinating one because of their flexibility moving forward. I mean, they largely kept the powder dry. And so we'll see. I mean, it'll be hard to know, but him having a voice in the process, even though us and, you know, NBA Twitter will be the lesser for it.
All right. We will be right back to bring in Derek Bodner right now. Time for another of our most anticipated teams, in part due to the enigma and the mystery that is Markelle Fultz. So we'll be sure to start off by asking about him. Derek Bodner of The Athletic, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Yeah, so I mean, that's obviously the place to start here. We've the Markelle Fultz jump shot, Drew Hanlon, the guru. It was a mystery other than just little leaks on social media. Now that jump shot has been unveiled, and I want to talk in detail about Fultz's preseason, but just on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, with 10 being, okay, he's back to looking right on track to where he was at Washington, and 1 being, you know, just still absolutely terrible. Given your hopes and expectations for how Fultz's jumper would improve in the offseason, where would you say it is now that Hanlon's work has been revealed?
So hope and expectations wise, this was probably one of the more difficult things to forecast. I mean, the range of outcomes on this was pretty ridiculous. And you really had no, like, in terms of expectations, I'm not sure I had one because I could have really seen any outcome coming to play. I would say it's probably on the positive end of the scale, you know, especially seeing what I've seen, you know, before games, in workouts, Like, I think he's on the right path back to having a workable jump shot. I think there are some concerns. You know, I think it's a lower release point, a little more in front of his body, a little more difficult to get off. I think it's better off the dribble in terms of a high release point than it is off the catch. But I think what I saw in practice, they're at least on the right track. Now, the question is, how long is it going to take for that to be a consistent weapon in games? And that I'm not 100% sure. And, you know, he had that one good game against Orlando, I think it was, where he came out and I think he shot like 5 for 10 on jump shots and one for 4 from 3. One of them was a heave and really good from mid range. And then he went over to China and he took a step back, not necessarily in terms of effectiveness, but in terms of willingness to even take them. And I think that's probably, you know, we can sit here and agonize over his form and really, you know, put a real crucial eye to it. And I think his form is probably going to be up and down a little bit. Like, I think whatever he worked on in terms of Drew Hanlon over the summer, I'm not sure it's repeated enough where it's going to be 100% consistent. But I think the bigger issue is he confident enough to take them in game? Is he going to, you know, if he misses 3 or 4 or 5 in a row, is he going to take that 6th one to really keep the defense honest and to make continued progression back to where he needs to be? I think he's on the right track. I think the form is immeasurably better than it was, you know, 6 months ago. I don't think it's a finished task. And I think the biggest question is going to be, when he starts struggling, is he going to be willing to take that shot? And how much our defense is going to give him that shot? We'll see. It really is one of the biggest unknowns to me. And it's still, I would say I'm generally positive while being grounded. You know, I think a lot of people probably saw that Orlando game, Sixers fans, not necessarily NBA fans, but saw that Orlando game and said, he's back. He's making jumpers in game. That's all we could have asked for. And I think there's going to be some times over the next couple of weeks where Sixers fans are probably going to be frustrated because he's not taking them enough, or he's not, maybe the form reverts a little bit. And I think we probably have to keep an even keel and say somewhere in the middle, because I do think it's still going to be a, you know, trying from time to time.
Yeah. The 3 to me still looks pretty bad. You know, if he's wide open with an hour to get it off, he's taking it. We'll see what kind of percentage he ends up hitting on those, you know. As you mentioned, I mean, I think both the willingness to take it, certainly off the dribble, like there's not even a thought at this point. And that was a big part of what looked so good for him, of course, at Washington. I agree with you. It's better. It's probably about what I would have expected. I would say, you know, I'd say kind of that's a 5 out of 10 for me to answer my own question.
Yep.
But I still remain skeptical that he's going to get back to being like the plus shooter that, you know, he was really drafted on that basis. And I think this is something that's going to affect his career probably, you know, the whole time. I think he looks okay shooting within about 18 feet or so, but still not quite the same even there. You mentioned the release point, the versatility of the shot. And then also just the fact that in today's game, you really need to be able to shoot that 3-pointer off the dribble to be, you know, the number one overall pick type of player that he was. Outside of the jump shot, what do you think of how he's looked here in the preseason?
Yeah, I think some good, some bad. Defensively, I think it's clear you can see his size and how that can be used. I think at times he can get blown up by screens, and that's common for young guards. He's going to have to learn to overcome that. In terms of running the offense, you know, I think one of the things that stood out early is he seems to have some chemistry with Joel in terms of getting him the ball early in post-ups. And it sounds a lot of times like that should be a real easy skill to have, but a lot of point guards struggle with that. I think his timing on that is good. I think he can see over the defense. I think he can find those angles to make those passes. You know, I think drive and kick is going to get there. Right now, he's not really getting to the line all that much. And I think a lot of it is because defenders are playing so far off of him that it's hard for him to get all the way to the rim to make those plays. And right now, you know, you're kind of, it's real easy to goad Markel into that mid-range game that so few people are really able to make a living on. And I think that's giving him very little margin for error, right? Like, if he's not getting the free throw line, doesn't yet have 3-point range, it's going to be hard for him early in the season to really be a consistent plus efficiency offensive guy. But I think, like you said, the hope is he eventually pulls that back out to the 3-point line, that defenders have to really defend him coming off the pick, and then he's able to use that to get to the line and get to the paint. You know, I think he's showing a lot of the skill set, but I think it's going to take a little time for him to really put that together into an efficient NBA guard, not just because of the questions over the jumper, but also because it's essentially his rookie season, and a rookie 20-year-old guard is the NBA is not really kind to.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I mean, the good news, I think, is he's still got that magic with the ball in his hands. He's got that beautiful dribble that he throws out in front of himself, the great spin moves, just kind of bouncing in and out of his moves, especially in transition. I don't know if he's been effective in transition yet. He's actually, his numbers in transition are really poor per synergy, but he's been getting to the rim, and he's able to still, even with the teams playing off of him, able to get in the lane and find people. His finishing has really been terrible, but I think that's something that's going to get better. I mean, he's getting there. It's not like, you know, he's just going up into guys and getting completely swallowed up. He's kind of missing some ones where you look back on it and it's like, okay, given the release point, that's one that I think he'll be able to make eventually. Although his finishing actually in Washington was probably an underrated weakness. But I think I'm not that worried about that aspect. And you mentioned the defense. That's probably the one area in which he's exceeded expectations, because he was one of the worst defensive guards that I can ever remember evaluating in Washington, just, you know, in terms of his effort level and stuff. But the Sixers deserve a lot of credit for turning both Ben Simmons and him into guys who try on defense when, you know, they were two just terrible college defenders. I mean, that's forgotten about with Ben Simmons, that, you know, he's a really good defender now, when he was just a complete joke at LSU too.
Yeah, no, and I mean, they're pretty much the two picture players in terms of, they have a lot of defensive tools, but they never really cared at the collegiate level, or maybe they were in systems that never really, you know, pushed them to care or made use of their skill sets. For them to translate and really be attentive on that end, which, we're a little early in saying that on Markell, but I think Ben played a full season where he was generally pretty, you know, he was pretty aware, and sometimes he could get caught sleeping off the ball, but he showed the kind of versatility on the perimeter and the one-on-one capabilities and the playmaking off the ball, where he blew away expectations on that end, to the point where you could really project out a all-defensive team in his future. And for Markell to do that, you're right. I think the Sixers deserve a lot of credit. I think a lot of times we look at development in terms of offensive skill sets and how that progresses through the early part of their career, but getting these young kids to buy in and use their, you know, physical potential on the defensive side has been a big plus.
Well, so Markell has been starting this last game in concert with his struggles. They are now talking about starting JJ Redick in the second half. What do you make of all these machinations?
I think what I make is that they're probably not 100% sure what they want to do. And I think if you ask Brett Brown right now, what lineup gives you the best chance of winning today? I think he would probably tell you last year's starting lineup is the one. I mean, that lineup was, I think, the best high-minute five-man lineup in the NBA. It was...
Yeah, 21 net rating, I believe, right, is the stat that we've heard a lot of places.
And, you know, maybe you have some concerns in the playoffs, specifically with Boston. There were some defensive matchups the Sixers just couldn't. They didn't have the athletes on the perimeter to defend against, and maybe you're building towards that. I think probably even more, you're looking to show confidence in Markell and the progress that he's made. My biggest concern is that if you've already committed to him in the starting lineup and you have to walk that back, then what does that do for his confidence? Like, if they're taking the step, they better be real confident that he's going to deliver on it, because I think it could be tough for him to then revert back to the bench. But I think there's probably some acknowledgement that making a change in the starting lineup is going to be risky. And look, we can, you know, focus so much on JJ going to the bench. If Redick played 30 minutes last year per game, what's he gonna play 27 this year? It's probably not that big of a deal. You're worried about the lineup getting minutes, and really realistically, starting lineups probably only play at the beginning of the first quarter and the third quarter anyway, so you're only changing that for half the time. They probably just want to get that lineup some consistent minutes, and we'll see. I think everything right now is still very much in flux.
Yeah, I agree with you that starting Markell does not give them the best chance to win, but maybe that's one of the advantages of having Brett Brown, maybe now the most powerful figure in the organization. He feels a little more security, and coming from that Popovich legacy as well, to play the long game a little bit more. Though I think that kind of mentality, in addition to some other things, is why I'm not quite as high on the Sixers, at least in the regular season this year, as some may be. You know, maybe they could also play Simmons at power forward and have Sarch come off the bench if they feel like with Markell they just don't have enough shooting out there. Because I mean, I really, especially before they got Bellinelli and Ilyasova, without Redick on the floor last year, like, they were just powerless. Like, they couldn't score, and they just desperately need his shooting, even though, I mean, I think weaning themselves off of a dependence on him, both because of his contract situation and also his weaknesses against the best teams in the playoffs defensively, you know, might be something they'd want to do eventually. It's just they don't really have a replacement for him on the roster right now.
Yeah, I mean, going back to Markel real quick for 1 second, you know, I think when you look at the best lineups Sixers will have in the future, what you hope, what if this thing works out, they're your best lineup is going to be Markel, Simmons, and Embiid with players around them. So I think they probably just want to grow that and evaluate that, and maybe starting maybe realizing that they might take a little bit of a hit now, but they, like I said, they want to grow that. They're kind of in the middle ground where they both want to grow their young centerpieces and also compete for an Eastern Conference championship. It's a weird kind of spot to be in, but I think they're trying to balance that a little bit. And we'll see how it works when, you know, you have Brad Stevens on the other end game planning against it. You're not playing, you know, meaningless preseason games in China, but I think it's probably trying to balance that. In terms of whether or not Šarić could come off the bench, you know, that was kind of when we're going through these hypotheticals in the summer, you're saying, all right, look, if Markel comes back, shows that he has the jump shot, plays well in the early season, who do you send to the bench? Šarić was the one I thought was the most likely, because I think there's, you know, elements within the Sixers who really want that, switchable perimeter defenders. And certainly Redick is not that, but I think if you have Markel, Fultz, Ben Simmons playing kind of like a hybrid four defensively, and Covington, you can make a lot of headway that way. But also just because JJ Redick's gravity, for as well as Dario shot the ball, and, you know, I think he ended up at 39%, he really came on towards the end of the season. Redick is almost always going to have more gravity when he's running off of those screens, and his ability to move without the ball, I think, puts a lot more pressure on a defense than Šarić, who's mostly a stationary standstill shooter. So considering who you want to run your offense around, and Embiid and Simmons and Fultz, maximizing Redick's time with them to me makes a lot of sense. And I'm a little surprised that he's the one who ends up going to the bench. But I mean, we'll see. I think part of it might be that, you know, I don't think Šarić is 100% comfortable coming off the bench. Like, he struggled with it the first two seasons when asked. He's always played better in a starting role. Part of that's because most of his bench time came as a rookie, and maybe he's just grown as a player and he would fare better now. But I think there might be some hesitancy from him to go back to a bench role, and he's clearly a longer term piece, so maybe they want to see whether or not this lineup will work because they know Šarić prefers that. I don't know, it's just a little bit of speculation.
Yeah, all right, let's take a quick break here and we'll be right back with more with Derek Botter right after this.
You must love hoops if you're enjoying another great episode of Dunked On. The Locked On Podcast Network has more hoops for you. Locked On has a podcast on every NBA team. If you're a Lakers fan, a Bucks fan, a Celtics fan, or a Mavericks fan, the Locked On Podcast Network has a daily podcast on your favorite team. All 30 NBA teams have a daily podcast at Locked On. Search on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
So one of Danny's favorite phrases is the juice worth the squeeze? And with Fultz, he's just such a fascinating figure. I could talk for this entire hour about him. But, you know, we've talked about, hey, what is the possible best lineup for the Sixers in the future? And how are you feeling about Fultz now in the long term? I mean, I think you can argue about whether he's going to be good this year. I think we both kind of agree maybe he won't be that good, you know, especially with the level this team is going to try and win at. But how are you feeling about him, both in terms of whether he's going to get to be good enough to be the kind of primary ball handler type player that he was drafted to be, and then also his fit with the other two big stars in the long term at this point, given what the improvement or lack thereof that we've seen in the jump shot over the summer?
So, you know, a lot of times when I'm talking about young players, I kind of go back to Ben Falk and the way that he grades like probability of outcomes. And I'm not sure I necessarily think he has less potential now than he did when he was drafted. What's changed is probably the probability of reaching that potential.
Yeah.
And I don't know, because he's still the same 6'4 guard, 6'10 wingspan, you know, really good handle, can get to his spots, you know, can showcase athleticism at times, although he's sometimes a little more of a two-footed leaper, seems to need to gather himself a little bit, but still really athletic when he can gear up. He has a lot of tools and skills that would pretend itself well to being a, you know, a really effective guard at this level. He never had a picturesque jump shot. Like, he was never, if you would have said, hey, emulate this shot, you probably would have never done that for him. You know, he had a real two motion shot. It was a little bit slow. It was a little bit inconsistent on the release point, which is probably what they were looking to address last summer.
And also, by the way, I think, you know, coming into that season at Washington, you know, people weren't like, oh man, this guy's like this awesome shooter. Like, that season at Washington was like well above where he'd been as a shooter previously.
But he made so many difficult contested jump shots, and he had such a high release point, and he had such confidence in that jump shot that it seemed like a really relatively easy projection to make. So now that that projection is a lot more difficult, you know, I've seen a lot of Sixers fans, optimistic Sixers fans, say, look, Ben Simmons doesn't need a jump shot. Why does Markel? Well, first of all, it's because Markel has to fit with Ben Simmons, and two lead guards who can't shoot is really tough to do in 2018. But also, Ben Simmons is one of the biggest freaks of nature we'll see. And 6'10", with his size, his strength, and his speed, there just aren't, like, there you're not going to find many of them ever. And for as good as Markel is, and for as many physical tools as he has, they're not nearly as unique and as difficult to guard as Ben is. And even Simmons last year, you saw in the Boston series, when a team gets a real good team with real good defensive personnel and a real good coach, has that kind of time to game plan for him, it's a little more, his life is a lot more difficult. So, you know, I think he's going to need that jump shot. I think his jump shot does unlock his dribble drive game and his ability to be that three-level scorer. Does he need to be, you know, knocked down from three? No. But right now, he has so little margin for error that it's like I said earlier, it's going to be tough for him to be consistently efficient. So I would like to think if he figured out how to be a really good jump shooter once, and he made the kind of progress that you said, right about expectations over the summer, that eventually he's going to work his way back to at least being a weapon on his jump shot. I do think there's pretty good reason for optimism. Like I said, take that physical skill set, take what I do believe is a strong work ethic, and progress on that jump shot that he will be back. But it's one of the tougher to gauge questions that you'll ever be asked, just because we don't have the full story of what happened last year. And, you know, if, like I said, if he runs through a stretch of 10 games where he's shooting 15% from three, is he going to have the confidence to go out for the next 10 games and continue to try to work on that in game? We really just don't have answers to those questions right now.
Yeah, I would second your idea that, you know, the ceiling is still there, but the chance of reaching it is much, much lower. You know, I mean, and I think really, you know, I would put it down in like the 15 to 20% range at this point, because it's all just too weird. And yeah, it's a little unprecedented, but, you know, most of the time in sports, when we see people have these like mental hurdles like this, you know, they're not really the same afterwards. And to think that something happened to him that it took him over a year to get back to the point where he's still not even as good as he was when he was drafted, I mean, that's just a major concern, right? I mean, you just have to say, like, hey, you know, you can work on this as hard as you want, but there appears to be some kind of a mental component to it that it is, if not immune to just working and reps, is at least, you know, makes that not the entire solution. And so it just, and this kills me because I loved him as a prospect. I thought he was the clear, obvious number one overall pick last year. I really enjoy watching him play, but it just, and especially then when you throw in the fact as well, you know, that they've got Simmons. And so, you know, maybe if he were moved, he might be able to thrive a lot more, but with Simmons on the floor as well, and Simmons not showing any signs of moving his game outside of 15 feet, maybe, nor should he at this point. You know, now he has to be even better than he might have to be on another team to really fit in with this core. And there's so much weirdness as well, just around like how it is that this happened, and, you know, his interviews about it. You know, there doesn't really seem to be like a good party line for what's happened. And it's just, you know, people are always talking about, oh, his confidence, and you have to kind of baby him in that way. And so, you know, all of that, just, there's just a lot of smoke there to make me concerned that he's not going to get there, which, again, it really pains me to say, because I enjoy him from an aesthetic standpoint, and I was very high on him coming into the draft, as I think, you know, just about everyone was.
Yeah, no, I was 100% behind that trade when it happened. I thought he was not only the clear number one in that draft, but I thought when you looked at his, you know, his middle pick and roll game, which is something that you projected with Simmons was going to be a struggle for him. Like, he wasn't going to really add that to the Sixers. And you said, look, this kid can do it. You look at his jump shot, maybe you can grow that off ball catch and shoot. That should be the easiest shot to learn. It was a pretty pretty easy projection to make. You thought their skill sets could work pretty well in tandem. And I think Ben Simmons has kind of shown a little bit in terms of off-ball ability as well. And the Sixers, I think, and Brett Brown are going to get creative in trying to force mismatches where he can use his size and strength. So I think there is hope that those two can work. But that jump shot has to be a plus, and not just serviceable, but it has to be a real plus down the line. And I have no real ability to project out 3 or 4 years in how that's going to look. Like I said, I think the progress they made over the summer is a start, but they have to continue to build on that.
So let's talk about the two holdover stars. We spent a lot of time on Fultz here, but Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid, both of them young enough to take big steps forward this year. Based on what you've seen in preseason and the reports of what they've been working on, what do you think the chances are for that this year?
So I think a lot of people are going to look at the Sixers, and I heard you and Danny talking about it. What's a low-hanging fruit for the Sixers? And I think Markel is going to generate a lot of that attention, and probably deservedly so. Like, if he comes back and he's a full set, we saw at Washington, that would certainly elevate the Sixers. But I think the biggest low-hanging fruit is probably just Joel Embiid. And that's a weird thing to say for a player who was, you know, first-team All-NBA, well, runner-up in Defensive Player of the Year, who was, you know, a really, really good player, an all-star starter. Second-team All-NBA. Yeah, second-team? Anyway, it doesn't matter. Not first team. I remember that now. But for a player
he didn't get
the Supermax. Correct. Yeah. I think it was second. I think AD was first. Anyway, this doesn't matter at all. But for a player that was that good and had that much success across the league, you know, I think if he stays on the court, and this is a different conversation than we've ever had before. This wasn't the meniscus.
Yeah.
This wasn't the navicular bone. He just got hit in the head, hit in the eye socket by Markelle Fultz's shoulder, which is a little ironic. But anyway, so he missed the last 15 games. Or the last however many games of the season, that cut down on his overall time play. They were conservative with his playing time before that point because he really didn't have an offseason to gear up in terms of getting into game shape. So if he just comes in, has no restrictions from the beginning, and is able to stay healthy, Sixers are going to be a much better team because of that. And I think this is the first summer where he's really had an offseason to work on his game and to work on his conditioning. He was rehabbing an injury, usually a pretty serious injury, a meniscus tear or a navicular bone, in previous summers. So I think just getting into game shape, playing more minutes, playing more games, and not getting fatigued as quickly on the court. And I think you could really see signs of Embiid when he got fatigued last year. A lot of those bad three-point attempts would come when he was fatigued. A lot of the bad transition defense at times would come when he was fatigued, and he struggled to run rim to rim. And I think what you've seen so far this preseason, he's making a real concerted effort to get good, making a real concerted effort to get good post position early in the shot clock. I think he's shooting about 70% on two-pointers in the preseason. And hopefully that sustains itself more, because I think one of his big takeaways over the summer was conditioning and post play. And for a league that has kind of drifted away from that, I think Embiid is sort of the exception. You know, I think if you look at the synergy numbers for Embiid posting up, especially when you start adding in possession ending events out of passes from his post-ups, it's way higher than a half-court average. And I think Embiid can improve upon that considerably. I think he can be one of the few guys who you can really run a lot of post offense through and who can generate looks for his teammates out of the post, but he's got to be in the shape to do that. And he's got to get a little bit better at a lot better at recognizing double teams and making the right decisions out of there. But I think he's probably the one who can improve the most on a pretty easy basis. I think Simmons would be easy to say he would improve a lot if he developed a jumper, but I don't think we're there yet.
Yeah, so Embiid, 14 out of 22 in the post in the half court this preseason, 33 out of 47 on two-pointers. The turnover rate is still sky high.
Yep.
Out of the post, 27% of his possessions. And a lot of those, too, I think have been the clean-up the post play, offensive foul type of plays where he's fighting for that deep position. But I love to see that mentality. I have noticed him running the floor more, doing those post-ups right at the charge circle, which, you know, are so effective because you just can't get help there. You can't get a front, or if you do, there's not going to be help there on the backside in transition, so you can lob over the top to him. And you know, at 7'2", and you know, I don't know how much he weighs these days, 270, 280 or something like that, you know, there are a few players who can keep him from getting there. And you're right, last year in the playoffs, he really failed in the post to generate offense against Al Horford, who he has a massive size advantage on. You know, Al Horford, the knock on him used to be he wasn't big enough at center, and And so, he should be able to beast those guys. And, it doesn't matter how big you are, though. If you're tired, you're not going to be able to use that big body and fight for position. And I think one of the concerns was, he's got all these lower body injuries. Like, do they have to protect him? Can he just not practice? Can he not get into shape? And I think it's good to see that at least with his work over the summer, he's been able to answer that and say, no, I can get into that type of shape. So I am encouraged there. Simmons, what have you seen from him? The talk was he would at least improve his jumper around the free throw line, which even that, he really needed to do. He says he's not trying to shoot threes at all. What's the look been from him?
Yeah, I think some people have kind of run with that. He basically said at media day, I'm not coming out and I'm shooting threes. And I think a lot of people ran with that thinking he wasn't working on his jump shot. And I think he did work on his jump shot. I don't know if we're going to see it in game action this year, though. We talk a lot about Markelle Fultz and his confidence level. I think you can say the same thing about Ben Simmons. The difference is Ben Simmons has never been confident taking a jump shot. So I think we overlook it a little bit, but I'm not sure he's at the point where he's confident, the pull up off the dribble from 15, 16, 17 feet and shoot with any consistency right now. And, I think his free throw form looks better. Like, he clearly made an effort to tuck his elbow in, and I think he's cleaned up some aspects of his free throw. We'll see if that translates to results early on in the season, but I think he's made some progress there. But in-game jumper, we just haven't seen it yet. And when he has attempted them, they haven't necessarily looked good. I think if you're going to see a major change from Simmons this year, it's going to be making free throws, but also seeking out contact. When he was at LSU, I think his free throw rate was in the 70s. Like, it was pretty absurd. He got to the line a ton because there was nobody other teams could throw out there who'd have the size to defend him in the post or the speed to keep up with him in transition. And I don't think he attacked that as much as he could have last year. And I think now, if he's confident in his free throw and he's playing a little bit off ball and the Sixers can run some action to, force a switch and get him a mismatch down low or get him on the move and use some of the new points of emphasis in terms of, calling fouls away from the ball. And if he's willing to do that, then I think you can get him some easy buckets, whereas last year you relied almost entirely on transition to get him easy looks. So I think he can be better, but I don't think it's going to be maybe the leap that a lot hoped for, especially in terms of the jump shot. Or if it is, we certainly haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, and the mention of low-hanging fruit, I probably was remiss in not mentioning the turnovers last year. I mean, we projected even before the season that they were going to lead the league in turnovers. If they didn't, they were second, I think. And do you think they can improve that? Or are they just, Simmons, Embiid, these are Fultz, these are just high turnover players, and they don't have a ton of spacing, and that's just how it's going to be?
I think turnovers are going to be a problem. I don't expect them to all of a sudden be a, top 15 team in terms of taking care of the ball. I think part of that is youth and relying so much on Simmons and Embiid. I think part of that is, their weaknesses. And I think part of that is also by design. I don't think Brett Brown is going to want to run necessarily. He's going to rely a lot on his motion offense. And I think he's willing to live with some degree of turnovers, not what they had last year, but some degree of turnovers if it can generate him more consistently good looks. So I think they're going to, be towards the top, the worst in the league in taking care of the ball. I think the real key to this is Embiid and his ability to recognize a double team, to pass out of it, to dribble out of a post up and repost, to find his teammates, to recognize a bad shot and a bad situation. I think he can get better at all of that. And I think he'll occasionally, show flashes of that, but I think he needs to put that together a little bit more consistently. And I think he's probably, if we're looking for low-hanging fruit in the turnover department, I think that's probably where I would look.
You mentioned Brown's motion offense. Zach Lowe and Kevin Arnovitz listened to their pod a couple of days ago, and they mentioned this idea that, hey, against this motion offense with all these shooters running around is great, but against the Celtics, against some of the best defenses that they're going to face, who can switch, who have versatility, that's just not going to work as well, that they failed really to get that working against them, and that, they're going to have to evolve a little bit. Do you agree with, I may be paraphrasing them a little bit too glibly here, but what do you think of that assessment, and do you think the Sixers see it that way, and have they made any changes, or will they make any changes along those lines?
So one of the staples of Brett Brown's offense over the years has been they're one of the teams that run pick and rolls the fewest, or at least based on synergy, which is basically possession and events, fewer of them come from pick and rolls in almost any team in the league outside of, I think, Golden State. And I think Brett Brown takes pretty, you know, I think he takes pride in that. Like, I think that's how he wants to run his offense. But I think he's admitted as much that he's going to make concessions to integrate Markel Fultz and his skill set and his comfort, you know, what he's comfortable with, into the playbook and into the offense. So I think we're going to see a pretty big adjustment in terms of Markel when he's out on the court. And, you know, maybe that helps arrest some of these problems. But then again, putting a 20-year-old, essentially rookie point guard into a lot of pick and rolls probably isn't going to solve your turnover problems day one. But I think Brown's going to make some changes. I don't think turnovers are going to be the main catalyst of those changes, but more Markel Fultz and there. I think, you know, I really think Brown is, he's going to push the pace. He's going to run off of a lot of screens. I think that's what he's always going to want to do. And like I said, I think he's going to be okay living with some of the turnover problems that come with that. I think where he's going to look is, you know, Joel, like, let's go to the film room. Let's show you these passes you're missing, or these, you know, these reposts that you're missing, and try to improve them individually more than change the scheme so much.
Yeah, and really that motion offense, who can do that other than Redick on this team, right? To really open things up there. And you know, you might say, well, you know, we need to move the ball. Like, we can't be selfish. Well, or, you know, we can't be static. Well, what's a Joel Embiid post up?
Right.
That's what that is too. I mean, that has even less motion probably than, you know, a pick and roll does. I mean, maybe you were going to run cutters off of it, Embiid, perhaps.
And I think that's probably what Brown would say, is that we don't run a true motion offense anyway, because so much of it is based out of Embiid and his one-on-one play.
What do you make of the idea that Simmons should run more pick and roll? Some were calling for that. I know Bob Vulgaris, now of the Mavericks, was calling for that more in the playoffs. They didn't really do it at all. Is the idea that he just can't be effective in pick and roll, do you subscribe to that, or do you think they could do that a little bit more?
I mean, I don't think it's going to be the staple of his game, but could they do it more? Yeah, I think they probably could. And I think a lot of it's probably going to come from skinny pick and rolls, where the defense has a little less time to adjust and to react and to switch back. And maybe you can
skinny pick and roll. Do you want to just elaborate on what that is for the listeners?
I mean, sort of where like the ball handler will start from like a mid post position and dribble off of a big.
Yeah. Some might call that a snug pick and roll.
Right.
They've actually been running that for Markel a little bit in the preseason.
Yep,
too.
They have. So I think a lot of it will probably come from there. You know, I think if you start from the 3-point line, I think defenses will figure that out. But I don't think it's ever going to be a staple of his game, at least not until he gets that kind of 15-foot pull-up jumper to really at least give defenders a thought on how to defend it. Like I said, I think probably where Ben's growth is going to be is a little more in terms of off-ball play and trying to hunt out mismatches than in pick and rolls. I don't think I expect them to make that a staple of his offense.
I think if it has enough shooting around it and you do it with Embiid, that it could be very effective, especially if Embiid can improve his jump shot enough to be a weapon, you know, in a pick and pop, which, you know, early returns on that are dubious. He's 2 of 18 on threes in the preseason. But because I think, number one, especially with Embiid being like this big beast now, you know, if he's really going to be able to fight hard for post position and, you know, you have to put a center on him. If you switch it and now you've got that guy on Joel Embiid, you know, that could be a big time problem. And then if you try to get help on the backside, you've got shooting on the weak side and Simmons, you know, can throw over the top and find that. And if you go under on him, well, then, you know, I think he can just get ahead of steam and he's probably going to be bigger than a lot of the guys guarding him, and he can meet that guy at the rim and score over him. And then if you try to lay back with your big at the rim, then, you know, Embiid hopefully can hit that pick and pop shot. So maybe that's not there yet this season. A lot of it depends on Embiid shooting, but I think that particular combination is one I'd like to see them at least try more.
Yeah, and I think Embiid could get better as a role man too. Like, I think a lot of times when he would, you know, receive the pass, he would take a lot of time to gather himself and bring the ball down, and just it took him time, and defenders could react to that. And I think if he could get a little bit better at keeping the ball high, going up quickly, I think that would help both he and Simmons out as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I was encouraged that one of the things that Hanlon talked about, because Embiid worked with him as well, was, you know, a lot of his turnovers coming out of these kind of garbage pump fake drives from the top of the key, where he just like puts it on the floor once, doesn't really go anywhere, and then someone digs down and steals it for him, that he either needs to like tighten up on his handle or, you know, have more decisiveness with those drives or just get rid of them. You know, I thought that was the thing that most annoyed me about Embiid's game, and I think led to a lot of turnovers, was maybe a little overestimation of his abilities facing the basket. All right, so there's been a little bit of a non-traditional path here. Let's talk about how some of the new additions to this team are going to fit in. I guess really, you know, if any of them aren't injured right now, I guess. Wilson Chandler's out 2 to 3 weeks with a hamstring injury. Zaire Smith, probably hard to imagine he'll contribute at all this year. But they did get Mike Muscala, and it looks like, is it Shamet or Shamet, by the way, Landry Shamet?
I say Shamet.
Okay. All right. So Danny is... I think actually that's how he's.
I mean, I also said
he can get the credit there.
I also said Sarge for years, and that was wrong. So I'm probably not the right person to ask.
Well, all right. So maybe the way to talk about this then is, how do you see the backup rotation? You know, obviously Reddick's going to be in there if Fultz starts, but outside, assuming they go with the rest of the starters that they have, how do you see the rest of the rotation shaping up?
Yeah, I mean, whichever one doesn't start of the Reddick, Sharich, Fultz trio will probably be the first one off the bench, unless Markel really struggles. But I think they're going to give him every opportunity to stay in that top six. And then it's, you know, I think when Wilson Chandler comes back, he's probably next among that group. I think Brown really wants his defensive versatility, his size, and, you know, his solid shooting, is occasionally solid shooting, maybe a little bit inconsistent, but I think he's a solid enough shooter. I think that kind of defensive forward off the bench is something they haven't really had here in the last few years where they've been a relevant basketball team. And I think he's going to be used quite a bit when he does come back. And then probably Mike Muscala and Amir Johnson will depend a little bit on the flow of the game and the opponent and who they're going to use. But one of those two will probably be right in the mix there as well. And I think at the beginning of the season, or at least whenever they're back to being healthy, I think that's probably the core of your early game bench rotation. You know, I think one of the big surprises so far has been Landry Shamet and the way that he has fit in pretty quickly here. And, you know, I think I probably, you know, when they drafted him, I didn't have a first round grade on him pretty much at all. And I think the Sixers are probably the right team for him because of Ben Simmons and Markel Fultz and them being big guards and the defensive versatility that they have. You know, Shamet, he was a decent pick and roll player at Wichita State, but you're not going to run a lot of pick and roll through him at an NBA level. Didn't really have the size, or more specifically the strength, to defend two guards, or at least you were concerned about that, especially with his athleticism. But the Sixers have flexibility in that they have a 6'10 point guard, and you can now, it's a little easier to hide a guy like Landry. And I think they've let his skills kind of come. Like, I think he has, you know, a very clearly an NBA shot. And that's when you're talking about, you know, if a guy only has one elite NBA skill, if it's shooting, that's a really good base to start from.
And a skill they desperately need on this.
Right. Team. And not only can he shoot off the catch, but he's a lot like Reddick, a much lesser version, a younger version of Reddick. But he is comfortable coming off of a screen. And I think because he handled the ball so much at Wichita State, now he's also comfortable if they jump a screen, he can put the ball on the floor and at least take one or two dribbles into maybe an easier shot or an easier pass. So I think they can find a role for him earlier than I would have expected. And look, is he going to play 20 minutes a night? No, I'm not saying that at all. But I think there will be games they'll put him in there and he could get hot and help them. So I think he will be in the mix as well, even maybe after Jared Bayless comes back from his injury. I mean, Bayless has been oft injured and often out of the rotation. You know, I think he played, I think he, after they acquired Marco Bellinelli, the next time he played was like game two of the Boston series or something like that. Like he was a healthy scratch for a very long time. So I don't think he's going to necessarily push anyone out of the rotation.
Yeah, with Bayless out, he's out. He's going to be reevaluated 3 to 4 weeks from when he suffered that knee injury in practice in early October. And then, you know, with Chandler out, I mean, really, either Shamet or Korkmaz has probably got to play.
I think right now Shamet is probably pretty squarely ahead in that fight.
How come?
I think they trust him off ball, first of all, trust his ball handling and his ability to at least attack a closeout a little more than they do Korkmaz. And I think they probably trust him defensively a little bit more as well.
Yeah, I mean, neither of those guys are great chicks, but Korkmaz is such a waif that, you know, it's really just hard to see him contributing much defensively. How about with the bigs? They got Muscala. They brought back Amir Johnson for 1/12, I think, of what he made last year. They got Jonah Bowden as well, although, you know, I'm not sure I expect him to figure it all this season. Is the plan, you think, for Muscala to play backup center, or may we see him more at the four, where he actually started in Šarić's absence on Monday against the Mavericks?
Yeah, I think they've really been talking about his ability to play the four a lot.
Oh, no.
So I think they like Amir at the five as a backup. So I think early season, we're probably going to see a lot of Mike Muscala as a backup four, which I am not in love with. One of the things that I think Brett Brown is pretty consistent on is he does like having two sort of traditional big men, and not traditional in terms of like back to the basket, but in traditional in terms of, you know, you've got your center, you've got your stretch four. And that's, you know, in terms of Dario Šarić, Ersan Ilyasova, now Mike Muscala, I think he likes having two bigger bodies in the game. And I think they're going to run. I would personally prefer to see Ben Simmons defending a lot of four. You can call him whatever you want offensively, but I like to see him at the four defensively, even Robert Covington at the four. I would go in other directions, Wilson Chandler at the four. But I think we're going to see probably more Mike Muscala at the four than I would optimally like.
Yeah, but with Chandler out again, I mean, it's really, there's no one else to be a backup for on this roster. You know, if you're playing, if Simmons is the point guard or the three or whatever it is that you want to call him in that lineup. And that really, you know, that gets me to the point of one of the big weaknesses I see for this team, and one that may be rectified in season as it was last year, is just, I think that their bench depth could be a major problem, especially with, you know, the injury problems that they perpetually seem to have. But, you know, with Chandler out, I mean, they're really relying on him to be kind of a jack of all trades, backup three, backup four, you know, and he's had a lot of injury issues in his career. You know, we don't know how much he has left. He really struggled offensively last year, although and in a pretty low usage role, kind of similar. You know, he's not really a guy who kind of thrives in a lower usage role. He was someone who would post up every once in a while and be versatile, but, you know, has never been a great spot up shooter. So I'm concerned about their depth at this point. Although, you know, they still have their room exception, they might be able to address that later on the buyout or trade markets.
Yeah, it's so if you look at it in terms of where they were last year, starting the season, they had absolutely no bench depth. I mean, Timothy Luwawu-Cabarrot would come in and be like your first guard off the bench way too often for anyone's liking, really. So I think they're, in terms of where they were last year, they're much farther ahead in terms of bench depth if they can get someone like Wilson Chandler back than they were at the start of last year. But you did also have two big, relatively big in terms of waiver wire pickups, acquisitions after the trade deadline in Bellinelli and in Ilyasova. So I think there is some pretty justifiable concern in terms of their bench depth, and especially in terms of their wing bench depth and guys who can play the 2-3-4. You really only have Wilson Chandler, and that's about it. And, you know, we'll see if they're able to add anyone, either in terms of a trade or that room mid-level, or maybe even wait until the buyout market. But it is certainly a concern.
One name we haven't mentioned yet is TJ McConnell, and he clearly, to me, has shown himself to be a rotation-level player, and he's always punched above his weight in terms of the on-off numbers, and that series changed somewhat when he came in to be a big part of it, and then even a bigger part against the Celtics, but also the Miami series. But, and you could say, hey, you know what, just throw him in at backup point guard, put Markel at the two, and now you can kind of move everyone down, play a little smaller, but you still have plenty of size because you got these guys like Simmons and Fultz who are pretty big for their position, Šarić. But then again, the problem becomes that fit offensively. You're throwing yet another non-shooter into the mix, even if he is an effective player.
Yeah, and look, I mean, McConnell has been a guy who has really, I think, endeared himself to the fan base here in Philadelphia because of the way he plays, the effort he gives defensively. You know, he'll come in and he'll pressure James Harden 30 feet from the basket, and you look at the size and the athleticism between those two, and it doesn't make any sense intellectually, but just watching the passion that he plays with, it's real easy to root for a guy like that. And I think he has come in and given them a boost, especially defensively. But like you said, how many point guards that almost refuse to shoot can you play in one lineup? And part of this might end up being depending on how Markel goes in the early season and whether or not he shows a little bit more willingness to shoot and to seek out his shot. And if he does, then some minutes will open up for TJ to play next to Ben Simmons or next to Markel Fultz. But if he doesn't, if that becomes a question mark, even if it's an inconsistent question mark and you don't know which Markel Fultz you're getting from a day-to-day basis, then it's going to be tough for McConnell to get the kind of minutes that I think he has probably earned. I think it's a questionable fit. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Like I said, if Markell comes out and he's more the guy of the Washington Markell than the maybe the one that we've seen here in the last two preseason games, and maybe this resolves itself. But he is a viable bench player who may struggle to get some minutes here in the early going.
Yeah, and you wonder maybe if it would be possible. You know, he is in the last year of his deal. It does have some value, but again, you know, just so redundant with Simmons, not to mention now with Fultz as well, that maybe they could just trade him for an equivalent backup at another position. And then, you know, I think he does have value too, because his cap hold is going to be the minimum in the offseason. And so a team that wanted to re-sign him and use cap space, and maybe that team could be the Sixers, but, you know, again, his fit issues with Fultz and Simmons or Laurie will be unrestricted this year, because they picked up that option. They could have made him restricted this last offseason had they wanted to. After his third year, this will be his fourth year as a undrafted guy. So maybe he could be a potential trade candidate to try to bring someone else in, but, you know, it remains to be seen. He'd be the best point guard on the Suns, at least. But they'll have to actually get a GM first. looking forward to talking about that.
Well, I mean, you could just have Sarver do it directly. He could run the team.
he may have already been doing that.
But no, you're right. I think with TJ, it makes sense that another team would value him more than the Sixers. And this is kind of, I've discussed this recently in the context of signing him next summer. Like, it makes sense that there's somebody else out there in the NBA that is willing to give him more money, and probably more importantly, a larger role than the Sixers will have because of having Ben Simmons and Markelle Fultz. And I think you kind of have to come to grips with the fact that even though you might like TJ, even though he's done, you know, everything right from going from that undrafted point guard out of Arizona to a guy you can actually rely upon, it just, the roster construction
where do you go to school? Arizona? Oh, he's clearly getting traded to the Suns now.
But that applies to a trade as well, where there might be another team out there that will value him and have a bigger role for him than the Sixers will. And that would make sense to explore. I think they're probably going to wait and see, like I said, what happens with Markell, how much they can rely on Markell, how much Fultz is going to seek out his shot. And like I said, maybe that might open up some minutes for McConnell then, but it is a tough fit. And considering where the Sixers were, the fact that we are, you know, I mean, I spent too many days talking about Casper Ware for my own liking over the years. Like, they pretty much ignored point guards, especially after the TJ McConnell trade, as they really started seeking out stars at any position. And to have too many point guards right now, where we have to talk about trading one, it is a welcome departure.
All right. What do you see, other than what we've already talked about, obviously, as some of the big strengths for this team?
I mean, defensively, they should be. Yeah. They should be a top three team in the NBA. I don't have the exact numbers on me. I think they were, what were they, maybe second or third last year? I'd have to double check that. But they were real high defensively. And I think they should have a strong finish there as well. You know, I think Embiid's good enough where...
Third last year, by the third, way, for cleaning the glass, yeah.
I think Embiid's good enough where he is always going to be a force on that end. And I think he's always going to keep you in the mix of those top teams. You add in the versatile defenders of, you know, Covington and Simmons, and now throw in Fultz, who I do think is going to be able to contribute with his physical tools and recently buying in. Like, I'm actually relatively confident that he will provide value on that end. And you just start off, if they start off with that starting lineup with Fultz, again, 6'4", 6'10 wingspan, Covington, Simmons, and Embiid, there's a lot of flexibility in that, a lot of playmaking, and I think they should be good on that end. You know, I think they're probably missing that one quote-unquote perimeter stopper. I think the way that teams are built nowadays is different than it was 10 years ago, but I do think they need a guy who can more consistently match up with someone like Jason Tatum in the playoffs, someone like Gordon Hayward, would presume.
So people thought Robert Covington was that guy. He did have a very rough series against the Celtics. So you do not think he is that guy then?
I don't think he's a stopper in that sense, no. I think his value
individual
comes...
defense was awful in that series. Really, worse than I remember it being.
I think his strength comes, first of all, off ball. You know, I think he's a real good playmaker off the ball. I think he makes good rotations off the ball. And I think the combination of those two, the playmaking and being in the right spot, is important. I think he can switch and credibly hold his own on a lot of matchups, and I think that's important. But if you're saying one-on-one, clear out, stop that isolation guy, that's not really who he is. That's not necessarily who he's ever been. And again, I think that isn't like the value proposition of those, you know, four aspects has changed a lot recently. But I do think the Sixers could use a guy who they can credibly put on someone like that. I think they hope that Zaire Smith grows into that. I don't expect that to be this season, but I think that is part of the game plan with him. But I think that is someone they could, if you're looking for a weakness defensively, and you can go individually, and Šarić and Redick aren't great defenders. But more specifically, I think they could use one guy who can really, like I said, lock down on the perimeter.
Well, and the numbers with Joel Embiid on the floor defensively, just staggering. I mean, per Cleaning the Glass, which has higher numbers than NBA.com, but 100.6 points per 100 defensively. And for reference, the Jazz, though certainly with Rudy Gobert on the floor, they were maybe even better than the Sixers were. But the Jazz led the league with, you know, 103.5 last year. So that's just ridiculous defensively. But in the playoffs with Al Horford at center, we saw Embiid struggle. Again, maybe part of that was being in shape. There have also been rumbles of a new defensive system that is going to help minimize the effect of stretch bigs against Embiid, help him stay closer to the rim. What have you seen in that regard? Have you been able to parse out any of what that's going to be and how they might try to deal with those sorts of players a little more?
Yeah, I don't think we've really seen a whole lot of that new scheme. They have talked about it, but they haven't really talked in detail about what that means. And I'm not sure they've really shown that throughout the course of the preseason so far. I think they've played a pretty vanilla offense. I think Brown has talked recently about having Muscala and that kind of a stretch big and how that can be beneficial in terms of game planning against, you know, a stretch center. We'll see. I think a lot of it's just going to come down to, I think they're going to make a bigger emphasis and place a little more value on, you know, defending your man one-on-one. And I think they were at times reliant on Embiid to provide that help, to have someone like Simmons come over and make a play off the ball. And I think they're going to try to ask a lot of these defenders to focus a little bit more on stopping their own man one-on-one. But we'll see. I mean, it's like I said, I think in terms of personnel, that's probably their one weak point. So I don't know. We'll see. But no, we haven't really gotten a great taste of what that new scheme is in terms of their preseason play.
What about weaknesses? We talked about the turnovers, obviously. I mean, we probably hit on all of them. The maybe lack of shooting, or at least lack of distribution of shooting. Certain kind of a reliance on Embiid defensively, maybe a lack of versatility, the turnovers, anything else that comes to mind for you?
Yeah, I mean, they don't really have a reliable half court scorer outside of Embiid. You know, Simmons can struggle at times with that. Like I said, I think that's one of the reasons why you look at him off ball and maybe you can grow him in that regard and get him some easy looks, because he doesn't really generate all that much offense for himself in the half court. That is, I think, probably the biggest one. You know, you look at people like Redick and Covington, they don't have all that much skill in taking their man off the dribble and even in just attacking the closeouts to get his shooters. I think Boston really exploited that and they dared them to put it on the floor and they really couldn't. So I think somebody else to collapse the defense outside of Embiid, and people like Covington and Redick getting a little better at being a threat off the dribble and at least giving defenders something to think about, I think those are probably the biggest weaknesses. And if you bring a guy like now Shamet off the bench, can he do that consistently against quality defenses? I think those are probably the biggest concerns, along with obviously health and guys like Embiid, specifically Chandler and that ilk.
All right, let's get into predictions here. I will go first. I am going to predict the Sixers. I think their over under is 54.5. I'm going to predict them for 53 wins this year, despite the fact that they had, I think they might have had like a 55 win point differential, because what they win last year, 52?
52, 53, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's good that we really prepare for these.
I think it's 52. I think you're right.
But, you know, and obviously they had that huge run at the end of the season. And maybe more interesting even is where they end up in the playoffs. So, you know, I think 52, but they have a lot of high end talent. This is another team where, you know, if they make some addition, I was saying this about the Lakers a couple of days ago, where you just add a couple more pieces to make everything fit a little bit more logically. And I think all of a sudden they look a lot better, especially as a regular season team. So I'll get your prediction for the playoffs in a second. But first, you know, what do you see their record being this regular season.
You know, I think 54.5 is a pretty good number. You know, I think if Embiid stays healthy, you know, they had that, I think it was 16 game winning streak at the end of the season. But I think they also had, you know, through early January, they had the hardest, the most difficult strength of schedule in the league, and they were playing above 500 ball. So I think those were generally, like, I think if you would have just sprinkled those games in throughout the beginning of the season and they won those, we probably wouldn't look at it with quite the same skeptical eye. So I think they played, you know, to that record. I think that was a legitimate 52 wins. I think they can be better. Like I said, I think the bench, when you compare it to the beginning of the season, assuming health, will be better. I think Joel Embiid should be on the court more, and I'm knocking on wood right now. Team is a lot more fun to cover when he's healthy. So I think he should play more, both in terms of maybe not minutes per game, because I think his minutes per game ended up being pretty high for a big man, but certainly more appearances and just expected growth. Like, I expect Joel Embiid to be better. Now, is that marginally better, or is that jumping into the MVP conversation better? That will determine it, but I expect Embiid to be better. I expect Simmons to be at least somewhat better. And there aren't too many people I look at and say he's probably going to take a step back. Like, maybe Redick can take a step back, although I think so far he's looked good, and I think he's the kind that will age well. But theoretically, he's 34. He could take a step back. Wilson Chandler, I guess, could take a step back, even though he wasn't on the team last year. But I think they'll be better. Now, does that mean they're going to win six more games? No, I'm not saying that. And a lot of times you get in this range of 55 to 60 wins, and a lot of it comes down to maybe how hard the team's, you know, really playing at the end of the season, how much they're focused on rest and being fresh. You know, I think they could end up, I'll say 56. So I think they'll be better, but I could certainly see instances where if they're not fighting for positioning, they could back off the throttle a little bit. You know, I think they'll be a good team. I think they're the third best team in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, that's, I think, where I would have them as well. And, you know, I think they will be fighting for positioning down the end. I mean, I guess you could see it where, like, Boston and Toronto are both so far ahead of them, and then nobody else is really close, so they just kind of settle in to three. But I think this is a team, especially a young team, that is really going to crave getting home court advantage. You know, that was obviously in the Celtics series. You know, if they'd had home court, I think that it might have really been a much different series than it was. And that was a closer series, I think, than people remember, and they just kind of failed in the clutch a lot at the end. Yeah, I mean, I still, you know, you wonder how many games Embiid is going to play. You know, is he going to play all these back-to-back still? You know, I know he's in theory healthy for the first time, but, you know, there's always gonna be, I think, an aspect of needing to baby him. And then again, you know, just the depth is a major concern for me. And then also the fact that they're gonna be, I think, sacrificing some games or at least some minutes to this Fultz experiment. And they're already not playing with their best lineup. And I think actually one kind of off the wall prediction I'm going to have is that I think Markelle Fultz will have a negative net rating this season.
Huh. I wonder how. I think he's going to play enough with Embiid, and I think they're going to try to pair them up enough.
Maybe they'll just defend so well that that's going to be wrong.
Right.
A positive net rating last season, so maybe that's a little too aggressive.
Yeah. Well, of course, a lot of those minutes were also at the end of the year when, as you alluded to, the schedule was not exactly murderer's row. I think he's probably going to play enough time with Embiid and Simmons where I don't expect that to happen. And if it does, then that's a pretty big issue. Do I expect that lineup to be a plus 21 or whatever it was last year? No, not at all. But I don't think they're going to fall. You know, I think, like I said, I think he's just going to overlap enough with Embiid and Simmons where I think he'll be okay with that.
What do you think best case scenario? Well, actually, here, let me ask you this first. So how do you see them, their season and ending up in the playoffs?
That's a great question. So I think Toronto has a lot of variance to it because of, you don't know exactly what Kawhi is going to look like when he comes back. And can he stay healthy? Is he the player he was before? And that's just a lot of change on a team. Boston, I think, is pretty, you know, I think everybody's pretty confident Boston's going to be a really, really good team. So how do you make up enough ground where you can beat that and beat the team that knocked you out? And like you said, a lot of those games, I think three of their losses were games that were decided in the final minutes. Like they played them closer than a 4-1 series would normally look, but they're also adding, you know, two all-star level players. So how do you make up that ground? And I think in order to make up that ground, and this is a team, the Sixers, who have a publicly stated goal of making the NBA finals. In order to do that, I think Joel Embiid's going to have to be in that conversation for MVP. And he's going to have to play, you know, last year, I think before he got hit in the eye socket with a shoulder, he was on pace to play, I think, 70 games. And in the second half of the season, he was pretty much playing every night. Like, he wasn't sitting back to backs. I think that's pretty much out of the way. So if he stays healthy and he's playing 70 plus games and he takes that step to where he's in the MVP conversation, that's the only way I really see them being a better team than Boston come playoff time. Like, I think he just has to be such a dominant force that he can over, you know, make up the ground between Boston's depth and the Sixers. And that's a tough task. You know, in order to be a top three player in the NBA, a top five player in the NBA, like, that's not something that comes around all that often. Like, it's a,
yeah,
he would have to take a
for
pretty
a big,
yeah. And so am I saying it's going to happen? No, but I think that's what has to happen in order for the Sixers to be realistically talking about an NBA Finals run. Or Boston just has a bad couple games, which can't happen in the playoffs. I think NBA playoffs are generally a little more predictable than some other sports, especially baseball, which seems to be a coin flip, annoyingly so. But I think...
Yes.
Real annoyingly. It drives me insane. You have 162 games.
That's a big
game.
Part of why I don't watch baseball anymore.
162 games is great for taking away variance, but 7 games is not, and 1 game sure as heck isn't, and it drives me mildly insane. But anyway, I think basketball is a little more predictable. Boston could have a bad series, but I think more realistically, I think Joel has to, like I said, work his way into that MVP conversation. He has the talent.
Yeah,
we'll just see if he's on the timeline for that.
Yeah, I mean, and really, he just did not play well enough on either end in that series. Certainly coming off the that orbital fracture, you understand why, and the concussion. But yeah, I mean, I have them behind Toronto and Boston. And now, yeah, Kawhi's health is certainly a variable, but I think he's looked pretty decent in the preseason so far, you know, to assuage that a little bit. I think it's more a concern with him of, does that quad issue recur than, you know, right, how does he look at full strength necessarily? Because it does seem to be somewhat of a chronic issue. But it does seem like something too, where especially going into his free agent year, you know, I guess that could cut both ways, whether you would try to fight through it and try to prove he's healthy or shut it down again with the big payday potentially there. But I think with a healthy Toronto team and a healthy Boston team, one of the big themes that I've focused on a lot has been, in the playoffs, sometimes your weaknesses matter more than your strengths.
Yep.
And I think that this team has some very severe strengths, but also some very severe weaknesses, and that those were exploited by Boston. That, you know, I think Toronto and Boston are teams that really don't have much in the way of weaknesses at full strength. So that's why I think I like them better in a playoff setting than the Sixers. I will also probably have them third in the East in the regular season, but I do have them bowing out whether they face Toronto or Boston in the second round. Although I think, you know, again, if Embiid can just break the system, you know, that's the way they get past it. I totally agree with you there.
Yeah, and I mean, it's not only just his individual scoring, but he has to be better at reading the defense. He has to be better at punishing those rotations. And that's really, I mean, it's great right now that he is so decisive in the post and that he's attacking so consistently. Now, the next step is using that to help his teammates and making sure that you're taking consistently good looks and not turning the ball over like he has. He has, you know, all the potential in the world to be the one thing that other teams just can't match up for. And I think that's going to be important. But like you said, he has to make use of that in the playoffs. And I think last playoffs were tough because he had that downtime, because he had that mask. You know, I think he has said that he didn't have his vision out of that mask wasn't perfect. And I think that was, you know, I think everything was just a step slow for him for those reasons. And he didn't play well. And I think Boston played him extremely well. I think they'll play him well again, should they meet. And he's got to be at the top of his game. And not only where he was last year, but like I said, he's really got to take another step in terms of setting up his teammates.
All right, we've kept you way too long here, but real quickly, best case scenario, what do you see it as, both wins and you know, final result this season?
I mean, the best case scenario is up there with just about anyone outside of Golden State and Houston. Like, they could win 60 games and make the finals. It's if Embiid's, and a lot of it's going to rest on Embiid, but that's certainly in play. I don't know how likely, but that is best case scenario.
I would say 58, and, you know, again, making the NBA finals and probably losing, but obviously if you get there, you always have a puncher's chance. And, you know, we'll see you could easily see Golden State and Houston not being as good as they were last year. And, you know, if the Sixers team makes it past Boston and Toronto and they're that good, you know, maybe you could even see them winning the finals. Although, again, what percentage chance of that? Maybe a little lower. How about a worst case scenario for these guys? You know, we're not assuming that Joel Embiid misses, you know, 3/4 of the season, but, you know, realistic amount of missed games for some of these guys.
So if Embiid's healthy for, let's say, 60 games.
Yeah.
I don't see them winning under 45. And that would be like,
yeah,
everything goes wrong. Like Embiid misses, you know, 22 games. Simmons misses time. Redick misses time. Like, I think they have enough depth in their first 5 to 6 where they should be able to withstand one injury and still play solid basketball. There's almost no scenario. If you're going to take out the Embiid misses the entire year, there's no real scenario, I think, where they approach 500. And maybe that might be a little optimistic, but I do think they have enough depth with Simmons and other high level players where they should be able to stay competitive. And to be honest, the East outside of Boston and Toronto, you know, you can throw in Milwaukee depending on what they do there with their new systems. But the depth in the East isn't great. And you lost Cleveland, obviously. So there are some winnable gimme games that will be mixed in there. So if Embiid's relatively healthy, I think, you know, if they miss the playoffs, it would be a huge story.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I see it. Same thing. I had 46 written down for that as well. Well, thanks again. This was awesome. Where can everyone keep up with your work before we go here?
I mean, easiest way is on Twitter at Derek Bonner NBA, but also theathletic.com/Philly.
Was there a Derek Bodner just with no NBA on it?
That's actually my own. I have two accounts.
Oh, yeah.
One of them for non-basketball stuff and one of them for basketball. Yep.
Oh, man, I need to follow that immediately.
It's almost never used. Almost never used.
Yeah, I mean, I am a little disappointed we didn't hear. Like, it's not like right after a game or something, and like you're not reacting to news. I was hoping we would get some solid, like, you know, Bodner East Coast swearing. I told you that before the show. Maybe I poisoned the well by saying that. But if you do want to hear him swear a little bit more, his Sixers Beat podcast is awesome. Probably the best audio way to keep up with the goings on with the Sixers. So that's fantastic too. And thanks again for coming on, man. This is great.
Yep, thank you.